The title for this morning's message is taken from what I understand to be a popular television show that is currently in its final season. We've had a mode of confession this morning, so I will now confess in this safe space that I have never seen a single episode of that show. I have no idea what it's about. But it seemed an appropriate title for the passage that we are going to be looking at this morning as David rises to the throne of the kingdom of Israel over the course of these three chapters. A show that I am a huge fan of, though, is also similar in scope to what we're going to see in the passage this morning, and that's the show Survivor. I saw the first season when it was released more than 20 years ago now, and was fascinated by it. And for those of you who have never seen an episode of that, don't feel bad. But it's billed as a social experiment. They strand some 20 people on an island. Sometimes it's not really an island. And they spend the next 39 days, as they say, battling the elements and each other. One by one, they vote people off of the island. And then at the end, a jury of some of those people who have been voted off then choose one of the people who's left to win $1 million. And so you simultaneously have to betray people and then convince them that you're worthy of $1 million. And it's fascinating because in the course of the game, the various people that play often talk about the distinction between how they're behaving in the game, lying and manipulating and betraying, forming relationships of trust that then must be broken within the confines of the game, and their real lives. And some people will say, this is not at all what I would do in real life, but this is a game. And then you have people who try to play with integrity, and they usually lose. It's a fascinating social experiment. But I think it reveals, as I watch and continue to be fascinated by it, what is really going on in our hearts when the restraints are taken off. It does deal with the real world, and I'm under no illusions about reality TV being real. But it does show who we really are in a lot of ways. And Scripture is similar. Scripture shows us the real world, not the idealized world we wished we lived in, but the real world. And Garth mentioned that earlier, that 2 Samuel is one of those books that shows us the reality around us, both the good and the ugly, and often it is ugly. And so we're going to be in 2 Samuel 2 this morning, and as we turn there, I want to situate us geographically. There is a lot that goes on in these chapters. And so if we can put the map up, you see the red dotted line is the territory that Israel, we won't say controlled, but at least that they occupied during this time. And this is where we want the story to be a little bit neater and tidier than it actually is. We imagine that Saul ruled over a unified kingdom and had secure borders, and David just smoothly transitioned after Saul's death into the throne. And the story is far messier than that. And the reason is because if you see there on the west coast, the Philistines control that territory perfectly, but they also exercise control over much of what Israel regarded as its territory. And this has been going on for a century or more. This is the time of Samson and Samuel and Saul and Jonathan and David. And the Philistines are the ever-present reality for the Israelites. They must be contended with. And Saul may not have ruled effectively over a united Israel. He ruled his own tribe and sort of led a coalition of tribes. And so the title of king is given to him, but it may not be thoroughly accurate. And so you see, he dies on Mount Gilboa, way up there in the north. That's how far the Philistine reach had extended. And they've killed the king of Israel. And Israel has scattered. Its forces are fleeing at the end of 1 Samuel. Down to the south, you see the city of Ziklag in Philistine territory. That's David's home base. He is viewed by the Philistines as one of their own. And while they didn't trust him to go out to battle against his former King Saul, that does nothing to destroy his relationship with them. They've given him Ziklag as a town to belong to him. And he spent this time posturing himself as a loyal Philistine servant. And so when Saul dies, the situation is far from clear. And that's where we come to as we approach 2 Samuel chapter 2. And over the course of these three chapters, if you picked up one of the sermon handouts, you'll see that there are three deaths David has to respond to. We're actually going to look at four deaths. And the first is that of Saul. The death of Saul changes everything for Israel. The anointed king, the one that David referred to over and over again as Yahweh's anointed, has been slain in battle, and the armies of Israel are scattered. And we saw last week that David's initial response is to lament. And he laments because this is tragic for Israel. It renders them leaderless in the midst of a foreign occupation. And the way forward for David is not immediately clear. It is not a simple case of, great, Saul is dead, now I get to be king. David has been anointed to be Saul's successor, but the path to getting there is not clear. And so David continues to respond to the death of Saul as we begin chapter 2. And so if you'll join me turning to 2 Samuel 2, verse 1, we find David doing something that he does frequently. After this, after he laments the death of Saul, David inquired of the Lord. He asks God for guidance. He does not immediately presume to just go and claim the kingship. He says, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And so he's asking, should I leave Ziklag, my base of operations, and go up into the cities of Judah, his tribe? And that term go up is a military term. It means to take possession of, to acquire. And Yahweh said to him, go up. The answer is yes. And David said, to which shall I go? And he said, to Hebron. And so David goes up, he and all of his men, and they sort of occupy the city of Hebron. It seems that they may have been invited, but it's unclear whether this is a forceful takeover. Having 600 families all of a sudden occupy your town is not necessarily a friendly sort of thing. He goes up at the invitation of God. It's not clear whether the leaders of Hebron invited him, welcomed him. But they're there. And in verse 4, the men of Judah came, the elders of the tribe, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. David seeks God's guidance, and he accepts the anointing of the people of Judah. That's significant because we know that Samuel has already given God's anointing to David. David does not presume to say that that is sufficient. He also seeks the will of the people that are going to be under his rule as king. He does not impose it himself. Then David is given a report about the death of Saul and what happened to his body. He now finds out Saul's body's fate, and we were told of this at the end of 1 Samuel, that the men of Jabesh-Gilead had gone through the night and taken Saul's body down from the walls of Beth-shan, brought it to their city, and given Saul a proper burial. Jabesh-Gilead is, again, far in the north, well beyond the reach of David's rule, and it's past where Saul's followers are today. And so he says to the men of Jabesh-Gilead in verse 5, may you be blessed by Yahweh, because you showed this loyalty, and the word loyalty there is that word chesed in the Hebrew that describes God's covenant faithfulness to his people. You showed this chesed, this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may Yahweh show chesed and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. David reaches out in kindness to those who had been loyal to the one who had sought his life. He continues to show in tangible ways his loyalty to those even that had been his adversaries, indicating that he will do good to them. Now, therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. He offers them a path forward. He says, Saul is dead, and there's nothing that can be done about that. But the Philistines are a very real and present danger to our nation. Join with me. Judah has anointed me king. Let us join together and face the threats that are around us. David shows steadfast love to the Israelites and leads with graciousness. And so in verse 8, then, we come to something different. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, this would have been Saul's cousin, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim and made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Abner was Saul's general, and he now picks up the pieces in the wake of Saul's death, and he takes Saul's one remaining son, Ishbosheth, who was likely very young, probably too young to exercise rule. And it says that Abner took him and brought him. He crosses the Jordan to get as far away from the Philistines as possible. It's the only safe space that he can. And he made him king. All of the verbs there are different from what we see of David. David receives something that is given to him. Abner's going to, by force, make Ishbosheth king. He's going to try and set up a kingdom in Saul's name. But it's clear that his claim to be king over all Israel is really an empty claim. He can't even occupy, he can't even be in the territory of Israel proper. He has to flee across the Jordan River for safety. This is a weak and tenuous kingdom at best. And Abner's method is the method we would expect, that a general is going to seize control, a strong man with a puppet representing the previous king, and try to set up a kingdom. And so as we look at these passages, we're going to come across four things that are true of David's rise to power. And the first is this: as David rose to power in Israel, he was given the kingdom. He did not grasp it. And this is true for us. We've got the map up again, and we've talked about this already this morning, that each of us in our lives is given areas of influence, areas of impact, whether we recognize it or not. And we have the opportunity on a daily basis to go about our daily lives, to wield the influence that we have, whether it's the influence we have with the people that live under the roof that we share, the place where we work, whether for pay or volunteer, the schools that we attend, the organizations that we participate in, whatever it is, wherever we are, we have the opportunity to wield that influence in a grasping way that's manipulative and forceful and controlling. We may encounter people who engage in exactly that way, who wield their influence in that fashion, or to regard our influence as something that has been given and that we receive open-handedly. David exhibits his influence as one who has been given something and therefore is open-handed and generous. That does not mean that he is not someone who takes initiative. We're going to see David strike this balance. He does not just sit back. He is not passive. But the way that he takes action is always as one who is receiving something first from God and then from others. He feels no need to grab hold of and secure something by force, the way that Abner seems to. And so in doing so, he leaves the door open for threats to his claim to the throne. And so it's not long before there's a conflict between his house, his kingdom, and that of Ishbosheth that has been set up. And so this leads to a second death, and it's the death of David's nephew, Asahel, who was one of his warriors. And so what happens as we continue in 2 Samuel 2 is Ishbosheth's men are sent by Abner to Gibeon, and it's sort of this arranged meeting for battle, and David's men go to meet them, and Gibeon was where Saul had set up his kingdom. It was a Philistine stronghold. It's a strategic center on their side of the Jordan River. And so it says that they met these two armed forces, and they're sitting down across from each other, sort of wondering what to do next. And a proposal is made: let's have 12 men from each army fight each other to the death. And whoever comes out on top, that will be the victor of the battle. It's a way to prevent widespread bloodshed and yet settle the question of who's in charge. Well, they arrange this. They go about the battle, and all 24 end up dead. The way the battle ends is they all stab each other mortally and bleed out, and that's the end of that. And it's unclear then at that point, we didn't have a solution for a tie. And what happens then is an open battle breaks out. In the absence of a clear winner, the armies do end up going at it. And Asahel pursues Abner strategically to say, I'm going to take out the leading general. And so as he's pursuing Abner, we come to verse 20. Abner looks behind him and said, is it you, Asahel? And he answered, it is I. And Abner said to him, turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil. But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? But he refused to turn aside. Then Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Abner is being pursued by this younger man who is noted for his speed. And he tries to persuade him, listen, turn aside. This will not end well for you. And I don't want to look your brother Joab in the eye. Joab had been part of Saul's army at one point. Abner knows him personally. He probably knew Asahel as well. Remember, David went to visit his brothers who were in the battle when he fought Goliath. Their personal relationships and histories here. And Abner says, I don't want to kill you. I got nothing against you. And Asahel is pursuing hard and will not let go. We'll see later that Asahel and Joab and Abishai, these three brothers, David's nephews, are zealous in their desire to see David on the throne, and there's really no one they won't walk over in pursuit of that. Their mindset is different than that of David, and Abner wants to avoid reckless bloodshed. But Asahel won't relent, and so Abner kills him in battle, in self-defense. Verse 24, but Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. His brothers take up the pursuit. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gaia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill. We have another stalemate. Then Abner called to Joab, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers? Abner calls out as a voice of reason to say, this has to stop. And Joab said, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until the morning. Joab acknowledges that he would never have given up the pursuit until Abner was dead, until the battle was decided in their favor. And Abner's words are what call a halt to this battle. And that question, shall the sword devour forever? Abner is one who, like David, is trying to preserve peace and unity. As David rises to power, he is trying to preserve the peace, the wholeness, the shalom of God's people by keeping them united. Division always strikes at the heart of God's design and desire for humanity. And David, as one who will be king, sees that it is his responsibility to preserve peace and unity. That is our calling. As we think about our spheres of influence, those areas that we occupy, our responsibility is to seek peace, to seek unity. And we hear that and we think right away, yes, but that doesn't work in the real world. And this is why 2 Samuel is so useful. David is living very much in the real world. He's living with Joab's and Abner's and Asahel's and Ishbosheth's, who are threats to peace and unity. And David demonstrates a way for us to avoid two errors. One is to just withdraw, to say peace and unity are only possible when we withdraw completely from the world. We just avoid it altogether. Let the world go its way in a handbasket, and we will preserve some sort of peaceful community outside. And we find that that community ends up shrinking, because once you start weeding out all the people who aren't fully committed to peace and unity, there's nothing left but you. The other mistake is to simply say, this is the real world, and we're just going to do it the world's way. David's story is a political one. There's no avoiding this. He is seeking a political office. And we as the church face a similar challenge of seeking to understand, how do we engage in the power structures, the political systems of our culture and our day in a way that is redemptive? This is a live question for us. But our goal must be to preserve peace and unity. And I came across this quote that's very helpful, I think, both in our individual lives, not going either of those extremes, withdrawing or simply giving in to the prevailing winds. See this quote here. Peacemaking, what we are called to and what David is about, doesn't mean passivity. We often think that it does. It is the act of interrupting injustice without mirroring injustice. We often think you've got to get your hands dirty if you want to do anything meaningful. The act of disarming evil without destroying the evildoer. The act of finding a third way that is neither fight nor flight, but the careful, arduous pursuit of reconciliation and justice. It is about a revolution of love that is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. David is seeking just such a revolution. And through his agents, he is trying to minimize the bloodshed and plead, as he did with the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead, let us now come together in the face of what is a common threat, rather than allowing the sword to devour forever. And what's interesting is it's not Joab that seems to speak David's heart here. It's actually the guy on the other side of the battle, Abner, that seems to grasp this. It seems to be that Abner sees the threat the way David does. We cannot allow the sword to devour forever. And so the third death that we encounter, the second one that David will have to respond to, is actually that of Abner. Abner's one of the most intriguing characters in this narrative, and his piece in it is brief and tragic. As we pick up the narrative in chapter 3, we see that there is a long war. Joab is willing to part ways that day, but he's still going to pursue this war, and it's a long war. And gradually over time, the house of David is strengthened, the house of Saul is weakened. And Abner is trying his best, I think, to seek what is best for the people of Israel. And he believes Ishbosheth is just the man. And he might be hoping that David will be persuaded to once again become a loyal vassal to the house of Saul, and that in that way together they might resist the Philistine occupation. He might see that as the best way forward. Well, Ishbosheth, what little we know of him, possibly because of his youth, possibly because he takes after his father, he seems to be a little paranoid. And he begins to see this Abner, his, I think, great uncle, if I've got the relationships correct, as more of a threat. And he accuses Abner of actually seeking the throne himself. And it's unclear whether the charge is founded or not, but it convinces Abner that Ishbosheth is not the man to occupy the throne. And so Abner says something profound in verse 9. He says, God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not accomplish for David what Yahweh has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah. Abner says to Ishbosheth, the man he had wanted to put on the throne, listen, if this is where you're at, I'm going to go and try to put David on the throne. You are a hopeless cause at this point. And so he seeks out David and begins a negotiation. Listen, I can bring Israel to you. I can make this happen. And David entertains Abner's suggestion. He entertains Abner's offer, and Abner does. He goes and seeks out the elders of Israel and says, listen, for a long time, you always thought David was the man. Well, I'm here to tell you that it's time to put him on the throne. And so he brings the elders of Israel to David in verse 20, and they feast together, and this looks like the solution. This is the moment. David, by peaceful means, with full cooperation from Saul's former commander, will become the king. And in verse 21, David sent Abner away after this feast, and he went in peace. He went in shalom. They're on the cusp of signing this treaty that will secure the future of the throne of Israel. Just then, the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, and it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Three times we are told that Abner left David's presence not as an opponent, not as an enemy, but he had gone in peace. And Joab, ever the practical strategist, goes to David and says, how could you let him go? You can't trust Abner. He was here to spy out our position. No doubt he's just now plotting how to completely undo you. How could you have done this, David? And David says, no. We've worked things out. This is going to go forward. Joab immediately leaves David's presence. He sends messengers after Abner, who was only a couple of miles away at that point, and summons him back and says, I want to talk to you, Abner. And Abner, maybe trusting that Joab and David were on the same page, comes back and he gets into the gate of the city. If you've ever been to the gate of a castle, there's all these nooks and crannies. It was a place of doing business, more than just a simple entrance. And the text says that Joab and his brother bring Abner into one of these little alcoves, stab him in the stomach, and murder him. Joab, out of revenge for the death of his brother, even though that death was justified in battle and self-defense, could not see past it and could not trust Abner and kills him, which threatens to undo everything David had just done. The peace treaty is dead at this point. David's response is interesting. He publicly curses Joab. He then publicly mourns Abner and gives him a burial and makes Joab participate in the funeral, humiliating him. And at the end of chapter 3, verse 39, David says this, and I was gentle today, though anointed king. David acknowledges, as king, I could have tried to force this, but I was gentle. These men, these sons of Zeruiah, that's David's sister, he's speaking of his nephews, are more severe than I. Yahweh repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. David publicly pulls no punches. Even though in some ways it could be seen that the murder of Abner may have served David's purpose as well, that Joab was doing David a favor, in some calculations it would have been the politically strategic thing to do to take out someone that powerful as a rival. For David, it's a murder. It's unjust. And he has no problem calling out not just his own servant, his commander, his ally, but his family member publicly for it. And there's an open question. If it's murder, why doesn't David simply execute Joab? And this is where we come up against the fact that we're dealing with the real world. There are realities David has to acknowledge. He can't be without his commander. Joab is militarily and probably politically necessary. But that doesn't mean that David is going to waffle on virtue. And so the third thing we learn from David's rise to power is that he calls out injustice even among his allies. And for us as the church, we must lean into this. As we enter into the nitty-gritty of the real world, as we seek to wield influence in places where business as usual means compromise ethically, we must never be seen as approving of what is evil simply out of political expediency. We must be willing to speak truth even to those that in large part we view as our allies. Because there is something more important than winning, and David teaches us that. He is willing to call it out, and he will make provision on his deathbed for Joab's execution in response for this act. David is clear that he is not willing to compromise on morality just because it's politically convenient. The final death then is Ishbosheth, because with Abner out of the way, Ishbosheth hadn't necessarily signed on to this deal, and so the question of whether David will come to the throne is an open question. And so in chapter 4, we read this story, and David is not a participant in this. It turns out there are other people more dangerous around Ishbosheth. He was wrong to mistrust Abner. Abner was the one protecting him, it seems. And so these two commanders in Ishbosheth's army see an opportunity now to kill the king and take power themselves. And so they sneak into his house, murder him on his bed, cut off his head and bring it to David. And all of a sudden, this story sounds familiar. They see an opportunity to deliver the kingdom to David by means of murdering David's rival. And so they bring him in his head, and they're expecting a reward. And at the end of verse 9, just like the Amalekite who brought news of Saul's death to David and took credit for it falsely, David says, "As Yahweh lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity." In other words, subtly, I don't need you to commit murder to get me out of a dangerous spot. God does that just fine. "When one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag," which was the reward for him for his news. "How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" David refuses to accept this gift. But in doing so, he calls Ishbosheth a righteous man. Ishbosheth, the son of the one who had sought his life. Ishbosheth, who has allowed himself to be manipulated by Abner to be propped up as David's rival. And as a result, the land has known something like a civil war for over 7 years. David calls him a righteous man. Calls his murder an act of great injustice. Punishes those responsible, refusing to see it as a gift. The fourth thing we learn from David's rise is that David is always able to see good even in his enemies. He is willing to call allies to account when they stray morally, and he is willing to see the best even in those who are his enemies. David is starting to sound like someone we know well, someone who will come from his line. So as we ask the question, what do we do with this? What are we to do with this messy Game of Thrones, this political story that's very much a part of the real world? It sounds, you could take the story and transplant it without some of the violence and bloodshed into our context, this struggle for power, whether it's in the context of the cubicle in your office or the halls of Congress, the story rings true as being what life in the real world is like. And yet David stands out as not in keeping with what we often encounter. And so I said the last couple of weeks that our gospel is a gospel for the real world. At least it had better be. Because if it's not a gospel for the real world, it's no good news at all. If it's only good news for some sort of fantasy reality, some ideal version of our world, then it's no good. But it is a gospel for the real world. Abner asked the question, "Shall the sword devour forever?" And the characters in this story, apart from David, seem to think that one more death will be what it takes. One more slaying will finally put an end to the violence. We know how that goes. There are bombings in Sri Lanka that are meant to be a response to shootings in New Zealand. And in response to all of that, a synagogue in San Diego is shot up. And we're not sure why, but my guess is that the shooter in North Carolina is living and breathing in the same air, whether they're directly connected or not. We see it all around us, this endless cycle of violence. And we want to believe that there's going to come a moment where it'll be enough, where that death will be the one that puts it to a stop. You see, the characters in the story think that this is a zero-sum game, that there are only winners and losers, and if we just kill enough of them, then they will be the losers and we will be the winners, and that'll bring an end to it. It's into this world that God says, therefore, the cross. As we approach the table this morning and as the servants come forward to distribute the elements, I want us to think about what the cross says to this world of violence, to this seemingly endless cycle. David puts himself between, both geographically, but also politically and relationally and militarily, between those seeking blood. He stands in the gap. He foreshadows his descendant Jesus, whose death is the one that can stop the violence. And so as we take of the elements this morning, we are invited to consider two things. One, that a death has occurred, a murder has occurred that can stop the violence, that can bring an end to that cycle. But we're also invited to consider what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4. And as we think about this map, and I invite you again, if you haven't already, and even if you had to think of other areas where you wield influence, to put your dot on this map, because Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 4 about the death of Jesus. He says, we have this treasure, the treasure of the good news, the treasure of the death of Jesus in jars of clay, always carrying in the body, wherever we go, whether it's our workplace or the corner store, we carry in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal bodies. It is as you and I go about our daily lives that we carry the death of Jesus with us. And that means that we must let go of our desire to control and manipulate and force. We must allow ourselves to be vessels, cracked and broken vessels, bearing the death of Jesus. And participating in the elements is a way for us to invite God to allow us to do that and to give expression to our desire so that Monday through Saturday, we are still carrying about the death of Jesus.